Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I have learned enormously from being in attendance and the wonderful discussions. So we'll try to contribute to the discussions by making our presentation short. I have a few points to make, and there are some slides that I will move through quickly, but I'll make a few points. The first is that although these are listed as the 21st century challenges, you'll notice that they could also be listed as the agriculture challenges. Each one of those global challenges has either directly or indirectly to do with agriculture, at least in part. So as we look forward to the 21st century and the global challenges as identified by the Academy's National Research Council, we realize how important agriculture is in the solution of those 21st century challenges. And the challenges all have been issued before. I needn't read this. And you know these as well as I. Increasing food production by at least 70%, including in meat, on essentially the same amount of land that we have now, made more difficult by changes in climate and weather patterns and competing demands. And I'm going to come back to this bioenergy and bioeconomy world because that is part of the future of agriculture, as it gives farmers the option to sell into the food market or into the bioeconomy. Now, unfortunately, the growth in productivity remains very uneven regionally, and we are, as you all know in this audience, we're not meeting the growth rate of the population. And the investments in agriculture are almost equally reflective in the total factor productivity gaps. You see, the investments in agriculture in Brazil has resulted also in an increase in productivity and so forth. So the greater the investment, the more the likelihood of achieving the factor productivity required for population growth. And even though there are large amounts of natural resources for agriculture, not all of those are invested wisely. And I come to the point in some of my discussions of indicating that the wise use of natural resources, including those nations which have natural resources for agriculture, have a stewardship issue, including the use of that land wisely. And food security certainly is amongst those that requires good land management, but it also can be used to grow a strong economy, and it's going to require advances in science and technology innovation in order to achieve the food security necessary in the next 30 years to eliminate the gaps in nutrition. But this has to be done on a sustainable as well as an intensive mode. And to do so without considering the sustainability of our intensification would be at our own peril as agriculture scientists. So much of what we look at is what is a science and technology, what is the knowledge industry and the knowledge base necessary to create the kind of sustainable intensification that will be required to make the food gap shorter. And this is the history of the initial genetically engineered crops that we have seen, whether they're insect resistant, virus resistant, or herbicide tolerance. The goal has been to intensify agriculture and reduce the use of agriculture chemicals. At the same time, there are secondary benefits that we have seen. We have seen that in some parts of South Africa and Eastern Africa, the presence of mycotoxins on corn is reduced by using BT corn because the BT provides resistance to insect attack, and the insects, of course, the larvae, carry and allow the fusarium to invade. The second benefit that was not planned or expected was that the maize, which has tolerance to root insects, is also more drought tolerant. So these primary benefits and secondary benefits are seen to accrue in genetic engineering that come along with the first several traits. Thirdly, the other benefit is that this technology is equally as relevant and applicable to smallholder farmers as it is to largeholder farmers, whether cotton in Burkina Faso, or India, or in smallholder farmers of maize in South Africa, as well as in China. So the results so far have been very, very positive. In fact, this technology has been so widely adopted and so widely considered safe that it's been adopted by millions of farmers, and more of these are small farmers than are large farmers. And these benefits that we see listed on this slide have had the health benefits that were predicted but not documented until several years ago. Now, with regard to whether or not this is a part of sustainable agriculture, a study was conducted by the National Research Council. This report was given in late part of 2010, and reports very positively of the impact of genetically engineered crops on farm sustainability, both economic sustainability and environmental sustainability. So the future of intensification will, in the regard of most of the plant scientists and agriculture scientists, consider that agriculture technology is indeed here to stay, and it's part of the future of sustainability in agriculture. We have a requirement to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, as well as in the production of agriculture chemicals, as well as in the production on the fields. There is a large amount of investment in the private sector and in the public sector to improve seeds. Less water requirement, less nitrogen requirement, less use of insecticides and fungicides. It's that piece of pest resistance, reducing the use of agriculture chemicals in general, that pulled me into biotechnology nearly 30 years ago. That was a goal. That was the reason I got involved in 1981. Lastly, the other part of this is not to forget the animal agriculture. There's also a great deal of work that's required to increase the feed use efficiency in animals. This will take a combination of animal genetics, microbiology, microbiome biology, as well as matching with the chemistry of the feed crop. In order to be successful, however, this requires now a different kind of agriculture training. The new agriculture requires increasing in collaborations across disciplines that we have not seen before. In the agency that I led at the USDA, NIFA, we required that our competitive grants be essentially pulled by the economists and the social scientists who first decided that it was a good idea, and then their discussion with the genomic scientists and the upstream scientists to create a project which shows the collaboration between the upstream science and the farmer. And in fact, that we think that's the best way to find ourselves in the successful agriculture of the future. However, to make that happen, universities have to adapt to change the way they expect of the professor and what they expect of the student. And these changes in structure and function of our universities will make agriculture more relevant, more successful, and more readily adaptable to the changing economies of the next 30 years. In the United States, the agriculture is valued as an export value of about $140 billion in this year. It's an important part of our economy, and for that reason, intensification and profitability is important, and a large reason why agriculture biotechnology has been so successful. This won't happen without the next generation of scientists. It won't happen without the next generation of farmer producers, and we need to find ways to attract that next generation into our economy. They are important for not only the economy, but for the well-being and the health and well-being of society, of course. Now, this challenge of changing universities and creating better scientists who can work across these disciplines, as we heard in this morning's session, is a challenge, I think, that we can all face, but it will take some realization inside of our academic institutions. And at the current time, our land grant universities, our universities that teach in agriculture, are undergoing those changes even as we speak. There will be downsizing, there will be right-sizing, and there will be a new agriculture university that looks forward to a more successful and different kind of agriculture. The next two slides are to show you that this is not a technology that is restricted to the multinationals. In fact, there is more research going on in the public sector than in the private sector in many of these different crops. All of the examples that I've given here are examples of crops and plants and technology developed in the public sector. By paying attention to the needs of the local community, the public sector next to the universities, and through the kind of technology that we all know, can make direct contributions to agriculture, whether it's in grapevines or in plums or in groundnuts. And these however, are often abandoned because of the cost due to regulations and biosafety. And I hope we get into this in our discussion period. And I think Paul's going to make another point of this in his presentation. And we'll come back to this, I hope, in the subsequent times. A couple of examples for you. This is some work done at the institution that I helped to found, the Danforth Plant Science Center. This is resistance of cassava for Africa, in Eastern Africa, for the resistance to two viruses. These plants have now been in confined field trials in Uganda for 2 years, and it's a spectacular result. There is no disease in it, and there's no disease transmission from it. This is done between Ugandan scientists, Kenyan scientists, and American scientists and French scientists, all done at the Danforth Center, and it's a public sector, public goods with no royalties to be paid. It's a giveaway. And from my perspective, this is a slide from my lab 25 years ago showing virus resistance plants and susceptible plants caused by genetic engineering given by the insertion of a gene for the virus coat protein. As a scientist, I was interested in why this happened, and I studied as a reductionist scientist for many years the crystal structures of the proteins, why do the proteins interact, how do they give resistance, and it's a great rush. I mean, it's a wonderful feeling to get down to the molecular level of understanding a resistance reaction. And I carried this on through modeling and structures. And then I met someone from India, because I was on the board of ICRISAT, one of the CGIAR centers, and I found out a disease of groundnuts that was susceptible to a virus disease that could be controlled by genetic engineering. And now suddenly this work that I had done as a scientist 25 years ago now has relevance in India. The trouble is the Indian government has decided that these field trials cannot continue because of the political backlash that they might receive. And it's something that I think we'll talk about again. So the investments made by the public sector are not finding their way into the public use at this point. The last point I want to make, do I have 1 minute left? 1 minute?
Two.
My goodness.
Three.
I told him I'd be done in 12.5 minutes. Is the future of agriculture. The agriculture is not just feed and fuel and fiber and food. It's the next part that replaces the chemical feedstocks, the biochemicals, and the other materials that are used in industry. And I think creating that next generation of economy is beyond food, is a way to provide to the farming economy or the agriculture economy an out, a second, an optionality, as we call it, for what they might use. And it's great opportunities for invention and for innovation, for investments and economic growth and development. And those winners that are in this category will use the best of synthetic biology, the best of systems biology, the best genetic engineering. But it will take the policies that are required in the public setting, in our government setting, to allow this to happen. You're going to hear from one of our speakers about the potato issue. But this part of allowing our farming economy to develop new opportunities in biochemicals, I hope, will eventually get to the point where we recognize, as other economists do, that this subsidization that we do of agriculture must go away in order to make a level playing field. To make that happen, we need the optionality of farmers to be able to grow what is best for their profitability. That has to be safe and useful, of course. But it gives the economies that are developing a way to use their land for other uses and provides a more level playing field for those in developing economies. And that's because plants are marvelous organisms. And using them as a large solar cell, to collect raw materials for carbohydrates and proteins and all these things that are the future to replace black carbon or stored carbon, requires a lot of research. We need the basic research to do this, but the opportunities, if we are successful or when we are successful, are manifested in a stronger economy. So those are the issues that I wanted to cover with you, and I look forward to discussion from my colleagues. Thank you.